Okay, good morning. So a fundamental question in biology is how an organism integrates multiple signals into an appropriate cellular response. And the organism that we are using to try to address this question is Salmonella enterica, which is the agent that causes typhoid fever and gastroenteritis in humans. And Salmonella has a varied lifestyle because it can be free living. It is found in water or soil. It can interact with mammalian cells, engaging in a biochemical dialogue that induces the formation of certain structures in the eukaryotic cell and essentially convinces the eukaryotic cell to take up the organism in a process that is known as bacterial invasion. And then Salmonella can survive and replicate within macrophages, which are cells in the body whose role is to internalize and destroy invading organisms. So the question is, how does Salmonella know that it's outside a cell, in close proximity of a eukaryotic cell, or inside a eukaryotic cell, so the appropriate set of genes is turned on or off? And to address that, it means to understand the process of signal transduction. And any signal transduction cascade, the way I see it, has five elements that one needs to define. There must be a signal that denotes the environment. There is a sensor that detects that signal. Typically, the sensor will talk to a regulator as a means of amplifying the signal, and the regulator will control the activity or the levels of the various effectors that would mediate a response. In bacteria, the most prevalent form of signal transduction, as we heard earlier this week from Jim Hawk, is the two-component regulatory system that, as the name indicates, typically is made of two components, an integral membrane protein that can detect usually environmental signals and modify the phosphorylated state of a cognate regulatory protein. Sensors can have three types of biochemical activities. One is the ability to autophosphorylate themselves from ATP, the capacity to transfer that phosphate to the regulatory protein, and the ability to dephosphorylate the phosphorylated regulator. I would say nowadays it's pretty straightforward to identify these two elements of a signal transduction cascade, sensors and regulators. They're essentially defined by homology. One can say that particular protein is a sensor because it looks like other sensors, and it's a regulator because it looks like other regulators. Effectors are not that difficult to identify because one can artificially, in many cases, turn on or off expression of a regulator and then use a variety of techniques to identify the targets of gene expression, since the majority of the regulators are transcription factors. But what remains pretty elusive, and this was stated by a couple of talks earlier this week, is that we don't usually know what the actual signal, what is the actual ligand that is being recognized by the sensor protease. And this is a problem not only of two-component systems, but let's say in mammals, they are what they're referred to as orphan receptors, and there are hundreds of orphan receptors, if not thousands, in mammals, for which one does not really know what is the actual ligand that normally activates those receptors. And in many cases, those receptors are involved in important pharmacological consequences. You know, they're the targets of many compounds. Anyway, we work on two-component signal transduction in Salmonella. And Salmonella has 29 two-component regulatory systems. And I'm going to tell you some experiments that we've done with three of them. The first one that I'll tell you about is one that is known as 4P4Q. And this two-component system is perhaps the major regulator of virulence functions in Salmonella. And it also governs the adaptation to low magnesium environments. And this is in part due to the control of genes such as MGTC, which is required for survival inside macrophages and for virulence in mice, and of MGTA, which encodes a magnesium transporter. So a few years ago, we he discovered that the ligand that the sensor for Q recognizes is magnesium. And this was the first example, it is the first example actually of a signal transduction system that responds to magnesium as primary signal. The way the system works is that when the magnesium concentration in the environment is low, transcription of FOP activated genes is turned on. And when magnesium concentration in the environment is high, transcription of these genes is turned off. So I'll tell you how, sort of to get an idea, how do you go about identifying the signal? The main element is luck, you know. other than luck, our rationale at the time was as follows, and it did work, was that we knew we had this two-component system. We knew it should control certain genes. So we did a large genetic screening to identify the targets of regulation of the 4P protein. And at the time we were doing this, microarrays had not been invented, you know, so it was a large genetic screening. And our idea was this, that if we could identify the genes that were regulated by the 4P protein, and if these genes encoded products of known function, maybe we could imagine in which environment those products could be important. And it turned out that during that screening, we found that two of the known magnesium transporter genes of Salmonella were found to be under transcriptional control of 4P. And that those magnesium transporters were known to be regulated by the magnesium levels. So then we hypothesized that magnesium perhaps was the signal that controlled expression not only of the magnesium transporter genes, but of the whole 4P regulon, of all the genes that are regulated by 4P. And that turned out to be the case. I mentioned that MGTC is a gene that is required for survival in macrophages, and that is an environment that we believe is low in magnesium, because if you take the regulatory region of the MGTC gene and you fuse it to a reporter gene for that encodes a green fluorescent protein, when Salmonella is inside a macrophage, this would be the macrophage, it would fluoresce green, indicating that the gene is being turned on inside this eukaryotic cell. And that led us a few years ago to postulate that Salmonella ascertains its location during infection by looking at what is the magnesium concentration in its surroundings. And the way I think this system works is as follows. When magnesium concentration is low, magnesium will not bind to the 4Q protein that will adopt a particular conformation that favors the phosphorylated state of the 4P protein. Actually, now we know that from work from our laboratory and two other laboratories that the 4Q protein has both the magnesium controls two activities on the 4Q protein, the ability of the 4Q protein to autophosphorylate itself and the ability to dephosphorylate the 4P protein. So again, when magnesium concentration is low, the 4P protein will be phosphorylated, that will promote transcription of 4P activated genes, and there will be little expression of 4P repressed genes. There is a positive feedback loop that amplifies this, because one of the 4P activated genes are the 4P and Q genes themselves. And some of the genes that are 4P activated are involved in intramacrophage survival. When Salmonella is experiencing high magnesium environments, we know that magnesium will bind to the periplasmic domain of the 4Q protein. We believe that that promotes a conformational change in this protein, or something changes anyway, that results in the unphosphorylated form of the 4P protein, and that will promote expression of 4P repressed gene products and very little expression of 4P activated gene products. The best characterized 4P repressed gene products are products that are mediate the ability of Salmonella to enter a eukaryotic cell, to invade an epithelial cell. And we know that in extracellular fluids, where Salmonella would be before it enters the cell, the magnesium concentrations are high with respect to activation of the 4P4Q system. And then you can think that it makes a lot of sense that Salmonella would express those genes that are involved in cell invasion when it is outside the cell, when magnesium concentrations are high, rather than expressing them once it is already inside the cell. Okay. Now, a few years ago, work that we done in our laboratory and then subsequent work that was carried out in the laboratory of Sam Miller at the University of Washington demonstrated that there is a subset of genes that were originally identified as regulated by the 4P4Q system that were actually regulated via another two-component system known as PMRA-PMRB. And that got us interested in addressing two questions. The first one is, what is the signal that is now being sensed by the PMRB protein? And second is, what is the mechanism by which low magnesium that is sensed by the 4Q protein promotes transcription of genes which are regulated by PMRA? So sort of take a step back and to summarize this part, essentially the world of 4P activated genes can be divided into two: those that are PMRA dependent and those that are PMRA independent. Those that are PMRA dependent will be turned on in response to the low magnesium signal, as well as the signal, whatever it is, that PMRB senses. Those that are PMRA independent will only respond to the low magnesium signal. So let me tell you what we know about the PMRB protein, which led to the identification of the signal. And this protein is an inner membrane protein, and that has two transmembrane domains, and that define the short 31 amino acid periplasmic region. If one takes that region from four different gram-negative bacteria and aligns the amino acid sequences of that periplasmic region, one finds that there are 9 amino acids that are absolutely conserved among these four periplasmic regions of the PMRB protein. Those are the residues indicated here in orange. And those residues include a motif, which is a basic amino acid, glutamate, any amino acid glutamate, which is repeated twice within this relatively short segment. That motif had been originally identified in two eukaryotic proteins that are involved in iron metabolism. One of these proteins is a ferric iron transporter known as FTR1 from Saccharomyces cerevisiae, and the other one is a protein known as ferritin, which is an iron storage protein in mammals. And that led us to hypothesize that perhaps this PMRB protein might be sensing iron. And that turned out to be the case. And this is going to be one of the few sort of data slides that I'm going to show. And what this axis represents is the transcription of one of the PMRA activated genes by measuring the activity of a reporter gene as a function of the iron concentration in the media that we used to do the experiment. And one sees that the transcription of this PMRA activated gene increases as the ferric iron concentration in the media increases. And that activation requires the PMRA-PMRB system because there is no expression in either PMRA or PMRB minus mutants. This thing is true not only for this particular PMRA-activated gene, but for all PMRA-activated genes that we have investigated in our laboratory. So,
pretty high concentration of iron, isn't it?
This is sort of 100 micromolar.
I mean, isn't that higher than usual in the environment?
So that raises the question is, where does Salmonella experience levels of ferric iron which are high enough to activate the system? That's, I guess, your question, if I restated the right way. So that's an excellent question, because this, again, was the first example of any system that responds to extra cytoplasmic iron as a signal, only example of ferric iron as a signal. As some of you might be aware, there is another, and I'll address your question in 1 minute. Yeah. There is another ion sensing system in bacteria, which is known as FER, F-U-R. And that system responds to the ferrous form of ion, but inside the cytoplasm. So let me tell you about PMRA, PMRB. So there are two environments which can have levels of iron which are high enough to activate the PMRA, PMRB system. One is the stomach. You know, after certain meals, you would have iron, and the acid pH of the stomach will favor solubility of ferric iron. And the other environment is actually soil, because Salmonella has been recovered from soil, can survive in soil, and soil can have iron levels which are actually much higher than these to promote activation of the PMRA, PMRB system. But essentially, the question is, even if you identified such a thing, how do you know, how does one know that iron is the physiological signal, the real signal, in the same way that I can say that magnesium is the signal for the 4P4Q system? So the way I think about it is as follows, is that by and large, I would say that the vast majority of two-component systems are not essential for viability. Clearly, that I think this is true, that I don't know, none of the systems in E. coli or Salmonella are required for viability, are essential for the organism to live. So I think these systems, what they provide to these organisms is the ability to experience other environments and to cope with particular stresses. So I think that a system that is, for example, 4P4Q system that is turned on in low magnesium, it is turned on in low magnesium because it mediates the adaptation to low magnesium environments and helps the organism survive in such environments. So one would expect that such a system would be required for the organism to experience such a stress. And that turns out to be exactly the case. So for example, 4P minus mutants or 4Q minus mutants cannot grow in low magnesium. In the case of the PMRA and PMRB minus mutants, they are very sensitive to killing by ferric iron. And this is illustrated here. If we compare the growth of PMRA minus organism with a wild type strain, they grow equally well in defined media, but the mutant that does not have that regulatory system is completely outcompeted in the presence of ferric iron and is outcompeted in soil. You had a question?
Yeah, just asking. You most probably tried other divalent or trivalent
ions. Yes.
And this is the one that had the biggest effect.
This is the one that had the effect.
Right.
So this is, well, so I can tell you, for example, the one that also worked to activate the system is aluminum, with 3+. The ones that did not work were cobalt, copper, nickel, magnesium, potassium, sodium. Ferrous iron doesn't work. It has to be the ferric form. There may be a couple of others, you know, that we tried, but this is okay.
High enough concentration, maybe anything would work,
you
think?
No. No, there is a specificity, absolutely. And I'm not going to show those results, but for the system to respond to ferric iron, it requires those glutamate residues in the periplasmic region. If one inactivates either one of those, that's sufficient to abolish the response to ferric iron or to aluminum. And actually, one can show, so again, although these experiments are genetic in nature, eventually we had to do biochemistry to show that actually iron actually binds to that domain, or that magnesium actually binds to the periplasmic domain of the 4Q protein. So that's what provides, in my opinion, evidence that this is the actual, there's a direct interaction between these ligands and these sensor proteins. So again, we have these two systems. We have, you know, PMRB that is responsive to ferric iron, activates transcription of these genes. And I mentioned earlier that low magnesium can activate the PMRA, PMRB system. And we have actually figure out how this works. And the way it works is as follows. The 4P regulatory protein controls transcription of a gene called PMRD that encodes a small protein that activates pMRA at a post-transcriptional level. What do I mean by this? What I mean is that it's not some of you might be familiar with classical transcriptional cascades in which there is one gene that encodes a transcription factor that binds to a promoter of another gene that encodes another transcription factor, so on and so forth. And then this other gene controls transcription of whatever gene of interest you might be studying. But here, the pMRD protein works and is required to activate the pMRA protein even when the pMRA and pMRB genes are transcribed from a heterologous promoter. And to my knowledge, you know, this is very unique in the way this pMRD protein acts, because it provides with the possibility of pMRA activated genes to respond to these two signals. So let me show you sort of how does this work in terms of some of the results. If one takes this pMRA activated gene PBGP and looks at what happens during growth in low magnesium, the gene is turned on in low magnesium in a wild-type strain, but there is no expression in a FOPI minus mutant, pMRD minus mutant, or pMRA minus mutant. And we know that pMRD works specifically on those genes that are pMRA regulated, because if one takes a gene that is pMRA independent, then inactivation of pMRD has no effect on the expression of such a gene. And what I'm showing you here is true for all pMRA genes which are dependent or all pMRA genes which are independent. And what this is, so the question is, well, what does the pMRD protein actually do? And for this, you have to keep in mind that the vast majority of two-component response regulators that are DNA binding proteins, like we heard about on PAR and SPOS0A and FOPIF and pMRA, they bind to their target promoters with higher affinity when they are phosphorylated. So the phosphorylated form of this protein binds to this promoter with higher affinity than the unphosphorylated form. So what we think is happening here is that pMRD, if it's activating expression of these genes, what it's doing is that favoring the phosphorylated form of the pMRA protein. And one can show with purified components that the pMRD protein inhibits this process, the dephosphorylation of pMRA, which in the cell will be promoted by the pMRB protein if the ferric iron signal is absent. Yeah? So what happens here is the following, is that if the ferric iron signal is present, pMRB doesn't care whether pMRD is present or not, will activate pMRA because it will favor the phosphorylation of this protein. But if the ferric iron signal is absent, but the low magnesium signal is present, then the pMRD protein is produced, and pMRB will serve as a phosphodonor for pMRA, and then pMRD will do something to pMRA. We know that it can interact with pMRA to prevent pMRB from taking the phosphate away. Yeah? And this is, in a sense, exactly the opposite of the phosphatases that Jim Hawk described to you earlier this week. When there is no iron, well, pMRD doesn't phosphorylate. It is pMRB, the one that phosphorylates pMRA, but what pMRD does, it prevents pMRB from taking the phosphate away, from going in this direction.
PMRD does both. Does the phosphatase action
and the... PMRD doesn't have PMRB has B has both activities.
Both.
Absolutely. So, and I would say that this, by and large, this is true for MZ in E. coli, is true for FOQ in E. coli Salmonella, is true for PMRA, and it's true for many other. Perhaps the gram positives are the ones that are different. Jim, no? I don't know.
No.
Yeah. So, but okay, so there are many which do and many which don't. Okay, so, okay. Why did I ask this? Okay, we
should.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
The amount of the activity one way versus the other way is just modulated by the amount of iron.
Yes. That's what I assume based on the in vivo data, although we haven't done, try to see how the biochemical activity with purified proteins is regulated by iron.
So if you have some D around, is there always a low level of phosphorylation of PMRA?
Genetically, this is what it must be happening. Well, it should be happening based on our, this is what the evidence are. And we can discuss the details if you're interested in. So basically, that there must be some level of that PMRB has to be phosphorylating PMRA. So basically, the substrate of the PMRD protein is phospho-PMRA. And phospho-PMRA comes from PMRB. Yeah? Because if you are PMRB minus, there is, because genetically, in order for PMRD to work, you must have PMRB. Yeah? So one question that one might ask is that how might Salmonella benefit by expressing now these PMRA activated genes, not only in response to the ferric ion signal, which is the one that directly activates the system, but in response to the signal that is activated by another system. Yeah? And this is sort of my fantasy of what happens with Salmonella is experiencing different environments or environments of different magnesium concentrations. So this cartoon shows that when Salmonella is experiencing environments of high magnesium, magnesium is the dominant and prevalent divalent cation that will neutralize these negative charges provided by phosphor residues in the lipopolysaccharide, which is in the outer leaflet of the outer membrane of gram-negative bacteria. Magnesium will bind to the 4Q protein in this periplasmic domain, and that will favor the unphosphorylated form of 4P, so there will be no expression of 4P-activated genes. When Salmonella experiences now a low magnesium environment, there's no magnesium to bind to the 4Q protein, that will favor the phosphorylated form of 4P protein. 4P will go and promote transcription of approximately 1% of the genome. That includes genes such as MGTA and MGTB, which encode these two magnesium transporters whose function is to take up magnesium from this compartment into the cytoplasm. There's a huge number of reactions in the cell which are magnesium dependent. You know, replication, all these reactions which are ATP dependent require magnesium. And the cell has to try to keep up the magnesium concentration in the cytoplasm constant. So the question is, if Salmonella is experiencing a low magnesium environment, where is this magnesium that is going to be transported by these magnesium transporters coming from? And my hypothesis is that that magnesium is coming from the bacteria's own LPS, or lipopolysaccharide. And that normally the lipopolysaccharide serves as a magnesium reservoir for Salmonella. And that's great because, you know, you can use that magnesium here for all the magnesium-dependent reactions in the cytoplasm, but that creates a problem because there would be electrostatic repulsion between the negative charges in the lipopolysaccharide. And that's where I think the PMRAB system might help. Why is that? Because some of the genes that the PMRAB system controls encode proteins that are involved in the covalent modification of those negative charges in the LPS by 4-aminoarabinose and ethanolamine. Those, by modifying those negative charges, those are neutralized and is making the magnesium available to be taken up into the cytoplasm. And there is another outcome of these modifications, and is that those negative charges in the lipopolysaccharide are the initial site of interaction of a group of antimicrobial peptides, or such as polymyxin that is produced by gram-positive organism, or a number of other antimicrobial proteins and peptides produced by a wide variety of animal species. By modifying those negative residues with these positively charged compounds, the organism becomes phenotypically resistant to killing by such compounds. So for example, when Salmonella is grown in low magnesium, it is resistant to polymyxin. But if it's grown in high magnesium, it is sensitive, because those antimicrobial peptides can easily displace those magnesium binding sites, magnesium from the magnesium binding sites in the outer membrane, because it has a much higher affinity for that, such sites than magnesium itself. So this is sort of a summary of what I've just told you, and it's that organisms such as Salmonella can integrate different signals. And in this case, the way they do that is that by having this connector or shunt protein that allows these genes to respond to signals that are sensed by another regulatory system. And one thing that we have recently discovered is that when the PMRAB system is activated directly in response to the ferric ion signal, PMRA serves as a transcriptional repressor of PMRD transcription. Yeah? So if this system is activated directly, then the cell doesn't want to have much PMRD around, so it will repress its expression. And this sort of creates this regulatory circuit, which sort of resembles a sort of multi-component loop, which are actually fairly rare in bacteria when compared to, for example, Saccharomyces. So essentially, yeah.
Your hypothesis, your rationalization, you were saying that by modifying the LPS, you can sort of get some of that magnesium. That sounds like it's sort of a short-term fix.
Absolutely.
Also a sensible rationalization that at low magnesium, the LPS is unhealthy because it doesn't have enough divalent and cation, and so it needs to modify it just so it can get.
I think it's modifying because magnesium will serve a better role as it's required for the most important reactions taking place in the cytoplasm of the cell. And I think all that these stress response systems, like many of these two component systems are short-term solutions. These things are not from now on, you know, you make this addition for your house and you're going to have it for until you sell it. No, these are until the organism is going to experience another environment. This is the way I think about it. You're right on target. So what I just told you is that there are, one has to think that there are, even though for the purpose of analysis, there are individual signal transduction cascades, by linking one signal transduction cascade with another, one can elicit a particular response by two different signals. This is the example of the PMRD protein. Yeah.
Have you ever looked at induction?
No, we have not. We're actually starting to do that right now. I like to fantasize that this is what happens. I like to believe that first, that those genes that are PMRD dependent or PMRA dependent will be transcribed only later. That first, the organism is going to try to cope with the low magnesium stress with the genes that originally belong to the 4P regulon. And then when things got a little bit worse, then it has to go and use this other set of genes. This is my fantasy, but we're actually testing exactly that thing. Yeah. So I want to tell you two other examples in which systems can interact. One is in which you can have another signal transduction cascade where a particular signal elicits, again, a response that is normally elicited by a different system. Or one situation in which one needs two different signals to activate two different regulators that need to act together at a particular promoter to elicit a particular response. And this example has to do with a gene known as UGD, which was a gene that we had picked up a while back, has been under the transcriptional control of the FOP system, and we knew this gene was PMRA dependent. So we knew that this gene can be turned on by low magnesium via the FOQ, FOP, PMRD, PMRA pathway. This gene can be turned on by the ferric ion signal via this pathway. And then we discovered that it can also be turned on in response to an artificial situation. We made a mutation in Salmonella that would allow expression of this UGD gene even in the absence of the signals that activated the FOPQ system or the PMRA system. Yeah? And that mutation was in a locus known as TOLB, which encodes an extra cytoplasmic protein, and these mutants have problems with their cell envelope. And that creates some sort of envelope stress. Yeah? And in this case, I won't be able to tell you what the signal is because I don't know what the signal is, but we know that this TOLB mutation activates another two-component system of the phosphorelate class that Jim Hawk told you about. And this system includes three proteins, the RCSC protein, the YOHN protein, and the RCSB protein. The system was originally discovered by Susan Gottesman at the NIH as being involved in capsular synthesis. That's the name, regulator of capsule synthesis. And that system is known that for many of the genes that the response regulator RCSB controls, it requires a coactivator known as RCSA. Yeah? And that's exactly what we found. We found that this UGD gene can be activated in the absence of FOP and the absence of PMRA, or the absence of both at the same time, if there is a TOLB mutation. And that activation requires this protein, this protein, this protein, and this protein. Yeah? Okay, so here you have this example in which you have, again, three different signals using three different regulatory proteins acting at a particular gene. Yeah. Well, no, this is believed to be the sensor kinase, and it's believed to have the histidine kinase and also have a response regulator domain here, and then the phosphate is believed to flow to a histidine phosphotransfer domain in this protein, and then the phosphate is believed to go to the RCSB protein. There is also suggestion that the RCSC protein might transfer the phosphate directly to RCSB, but I would say that it's perhaps controversial that.
IOJN is a membrane?
Yes, it is. Two transmembrane domains. Yes.
And it has a histidine phosphotransferase domain, but no kinase domain?
Yes.
And the fact that you say it's regulated by three as opposed to two component systems is through the fact that PMRA can only act when
iron is present or low magnesium is present.
Right, but through the action of what is PMRD, right?
No. PMRD was only required to activate PMRA in response to the low magnesium signal.
Right, but that's how the magnesium signal gets coupled.
Yes.
To the iron signal.
No, it doesn't get coupled. So that's the beauty of the system, that low magnesium can activate the system regardless of what the iron signal is, in the absence of the iron signal. And iron can activate the system in the absence of the low magnesium signal. And TOLB can activate this TOLB mutation can activate expression in the absence of the other two signals. So essentially that there are three different ways of activating a particular gene. It's, in this case, it's OR. Well, same level. No, it's not the same level. You know, I have the same level. No, it's not necessarily the same level. No.
I think he wants to also know if it's additive. Yeah.
Right. Well, it's with the TOLB, for technologies, this mutant it couldn't grow in the same media that we did the experiments in low magnesium and ferric ion, so we couldn't evaluate this. You can't check, if you have the iron signal and the low magnesium signal, you get more expression in the presence of both than in iron alone. Well, this one where now remade a new mutant that will grow in this defined media will be able to address that. Yes. I'm not sure it can bind DNA by itself. It's not that clear. No, it is completely encoded in a different part of the genome. The gene for YOHN and RCSB are in the same operon. This is in a different transcriptional unit, which is immediately adjacent to YOHN and RCSB, but transcribed in the opposite direction. And this one is someplace else.
So it is potentially regulated by something else, and there is another input.
Yeah, potentially, yeah. Okay, so here. So far, so good. This is the only thing that, well, not the only, maybe it gets complicated a little bit. So what's the story here? So I mentioned earlier that ferric iron will coordinately activate transcription of all PMRA-regulated genes. And if one has a PMRA minus mutation, that prevents the ferric iron activation of such genes. That is true for all PMRA-activated genes that we have examined except for one, and that's UGD. So, and the N is like 6 or 7. So for 6 or 7 genes that are PMRA-regulated, if one is exposes the bacteria to ferric iron, if the cell is PMRA-minus, there is no expression. There's one exception, UGD. There is a little bit of expression. Suppose sort of 3-fold or 4-fold lower than in a wild-type strain, but there is some expression. So we try to address who is responsible for this expression in a PMRA-minus mutant. And when one does that, and does genetic analysis to identify the regulators, one finds if there is, in a PMRA-minus mutant, exposed to ferric iron and low magnesium, that's the in vitro condition that we did the experiment, the UGD gene is turned on, requiring both RCSB and FOP. And this is interesting, in my opinion. And here, I don't want to imply that ferric iron is being sensed by RCSC or YOHN. What I want to imply is that a PMRA-minus mutant is more sensitive to killing by ferric iron, and ferric iron will promote, will disrupt the iron membrane. And so there is some stress that is promoted by ferric iron in a PMRA-minus mutant that activates this system somehow. But the important thing here is that this activation of UGD under these conditions does not involve RCSA, but involves FOP. Yeah? So what this means is that the RCSB protein can use different partners depending on the signal that is activating the cells is experiencing. If the signal is low magnesium and ferric iron, it will partner with the FOP protein. But if the signal is TOLB mutation, then that activation of the UGD promoter requires RCSA and does not require FOP4Q. Yeah? And this is interesting because, especially in eukaryotes, one sees that different signals obviously would elicit different responses, but yet they involve the same intermediary protein or factor. And this is a very analogous situation. And the question is, how does this occur? Okay, so if we, experiments that were, there is RCSA produced. We know that there is RCSA. At this, I don't know. I don't know. This is the. This is what happens, and I don't. I don't know.
So, I'm
getting a little lost. So the FCSB needs to have one or the other part.
You absolutely, yes. In this promoter, it must have one or the other. It will not work by itself.
Okay.
There are, and in all other cases that have been described, RCSB was working with RCSA. And there are a few cases that RCSB appears to work alone. Work alone means that they know that it did not require RCSA, but it could be that it requires something else. You cannot exclude that something else is not being involved. They only knew that RCSA was not required. We were surprised to find that RCSA was not required, and then we tried to see whether there was something else, and then we found this SWAPI being involved. So, yeah. Genetics only.
So it's not known that actually out the promoters that proteins form a complex?
No, I know that all these, the RCSB protein, that the FOPI protein and the PMRA protein can individually bind to the UGD promoter.
And do they bind at similar overlapping sites?
I wasn't planning on showing that, but maybe there is time later I can show you or discuss it with you. Yeah. That's one of the slides that was eliminated. Yeah. So one thing is that a few years ago, the laboratory of Stan Falco looked at expression of this UGD gene inside a macrophage. And again, they made a fusion to the green fluorescent protein, and they got green bacteria inside a macrophage. And these bacteria, which are stained red, are outside the cell, and then don't fluoresce green because whatever signal is inside the macrophage is not turning them on. Now, we have, in this particular case, a unique opportunity to examine what might be the signal and what might be the regulatory system that is responsible for turning on expression of a gene inside a macrophage when we have a situation that this gene can respond to different signals. And one can address that by looking at expression inside a macrophage in mutants which are defective either in PMRA, FOP, or RCSB, the three factors, yeah. We also did RCSA, but it's not shown here. And the important result here is that if the cell is FOP minus or FOQ minus for that matter, there is no expression of the UGD gene inside a macrophage, whereas if it is PMRA minus or RCSB minus, there is. And what these results indicate is that the signal that PMRA responds to in a direct fashion via PMRB, which is ferric iron, and the signal that activates RCSB directly, not known, but in our experiments mimicked by this TOLB mutation, must not exist at high enough levels inside a macrophage to activate the system, because these proteins are present in a FOPI minus mutant, yet they are unable to activate the system. And again, reinforces the concept that low magnesium is a critical signal for Salmonella to activate gene expression inside host cells. Okay, so here there are two options. I can stop, or I can continue with the next story. Continue? Okay. So this is a different story, and it's a much shorter story. And this is another area of interest for our lab, which is, what is the genetic basis for the phenotypic differences that exist between related bacterial species? And this is work that started several years ago, myself with a friend, Howard Ochman, who is an evolutionary biologist at the university, now at University of Arizona in Tucson. And basically this work has been based on comparisons of Salmonella and E. coli. We normally think of E. coli, especially K12, as part of our normal flora. And we thought about three or four different mechanisms that could account for the phenotypic differences between these two bacterial species, which are closely related to one another. One is the presence of species-specific genes, or the absence of species-specific genes. You know, and this is perhaps the most intuitive mechanism. You know, we can think of, you know, Salmonella can, for example, invade a eukaryotic cell because it has a chunk of 40 kilobases worth of DNA that E. coli K12 does not have, and that piece of DNA by and large harbors the Salmonella invasion proteins, invasion machinery, and that's where Salmonella can gain access to eukaryotic cells and E. coli cannot. Now, E. coli is a commensal of of mammals because it harbors, in part because it has the lac operon, which allows it to break down lactose, which is in milk. And Salmonella does not have the lac operon, and you don't find it as being a commensal. If you have Salmonella, it means that you're sick or you're a carrier of this organism. So that's perhaps the most intuitive way of thinking about, you know, what could account for phenotypic differences, gene content. But there are two other mechanisms that could also exist. One is the differential regulation of the same complement of genes, and another one, the presence of allelic differences between homologous genes. And I want to tell you briefly about an example in which the differential regulation of homologous genes, the same complement of genes, results from allelic differences between a homologous regulatory gene. And we're going to stay with the same cast of characters that I've been telling you about. And if we do pairwise comparisons of these proteins encoded in the Salmonella and E. coli genomes, what we find, surprisingly, is that the PMRD proteins are only 55.3% identical. And that's a very low value because the median amino acid identity between E. coli and Salmonella proteins is 90%. And if you look at 4P, 4Q, PMRA, PMRB, the values are not very different from that 90%. So PMRD is clearly different. And that led us to hypothesize that perhaps PMRD in E. coli is unable to do what it does in Salmonella. And I'm just going to tell you what the results are. And the results are that PMRD in E. coli is present in the genome and is turned on in low magnesium in a 4P-dependent fashion, just like in Salmonella. And it makes a PMRD protein, but that PMRD protein is unable to protect, apparently, the phosphorylated state of the PMRA protein. Therefore, the PMRA-regulated genes cannot be turned on in response to the low magnesium signal. Yet, ferric iron will activate PBGP gene of E. coli in response in a PMRA-dependent fashion. So this part of the pathway E. coli has, this part it has, but it doesn't have this, the arrow that Salmonella has. So these are the difference. So we could actually go and we went and took this E. coli and replaced the PMRD gene, but just the open reading frame from the start codon AUG to the stop codon and put it into the E. coli chromosome so that the Salmonella PMRD gene would be expressed from the E. coli PMRD promoter at its normal chromosomal location. And that is sufficient to make this connection. Now, this has important, I think, phenotypic consequences because an organism such as Salmonella can use PMRA-regulated genes in more than one environment, can use it in response to ferric iron or low magnesium. You know, some of this antimicrobial, for example, this polymyxin is made by a soil bacterium, and ferric iron is high in could be high in certain types of soil, and some of these PMRA-regulated genes mediate resistance to polymyxin. But there are certain other antimicrobial compounds which are made in low magnesium to which these target genes could confer resistance, and Salmonella would be able to be resistant because low magnesium would activate these target genes. E. coli, by not having this connection, would only be able to use these gene products in one particular environment, not in another environment. I have four questions at the same time. Yeah, so anybody?
So, is it known what PMRD does in E. coli? Why it's there?
No. That's the question. I mean, the gene is transcribed. The protein is made, and we've done actually now some gene chip experiments, and we're trying to analyze that and try to see what it might be doing in E. coli. Yeah?
When you replace the E. coli,
Okay, let me show you one thing.
pathogens, but the MRD.
I should answer like, you know, I have Marcelio Schechter asked that answer. Just because somebody might ask you a question that you don't know how to answer, you don't have that to do that to me. Okay. Now, I know how to answer. So actually, the sequence is very conserved. It's very conserved, but actually, surprisingly, within the Salmonella, maybe the pre-MRD protein is 85 amino acids long in Salmonella, 88 amino acids long in E. coli. Within the E. coli, actually, they're fairly divergent. They could be, as I would say, even 90% identical only within the E. coli, which usually you think within the E. coli at the nucleotide level, things being 99% identical. So there is some divergence even within. So we compare the uropathogenic E. coli, the 0157A7, and W3110 and MG1655 are identical. And now we're sequencing from a large collection to see whether this phenotype that we have identified only in W3110 and MG1655, the two sequence and well-characterized K12 strains, also applies to strains, to wild strains. So I don't know, we're doing that. So going back to Mike's question, so the thing is this, if Salmonella grows, again, in low magnesium, it will be resistant to polymyxin, and if it grows in the presence of ferric iron, it will be resistant to polymyxin. E. coli will only be resistant to polymyxin in response to the iron signal. If you have now the E. coli that expresses the Salmonella PMRD, it will also be resistant in response to low magnesium. But that's as far as we've taken it in terms of phenotypes. So I'll finish here by acknowledging the people who started the whole business of gene regulation, which are, you know, Jacob and Monod. And I'll quote both of them. You know, Jacob, from his most recent book, at least in English, is Of Flies, Mice, and Men. And what he writes is that organisms of the most different sorts are constructed from the very same battery of genes, and that the diversity of life forms results from small changes in the regulatory systems that govern expression of these genes, which is sort of the story that I just told you about PMRD, except that when he writes this, he's referring to higher eukaryotes. He's not really referring to bacteria. He's sort of echoing what's known as the regulatory hypothesis from Mary Clark King and Alan Wilson, that in 1975, they ascribed to differences in gene regulation, the phenotypic differences that exist between human and chimpanzees, because even with the limited sequence information that was available at the time, human and chimpanzees have proteins that which are 98, 99% identical, but some of us like to believe that we're different from chimps. So, and they say, well, it must be that it's not the gene content itself, but it's the way we regulate the same set of genes that we have. And this idea is sort of reinforced with the sort of sequencing of the mouse and human genomes, and knowing that 99% of the mouse genes have counterparts in humans. Now, what I'm just telling you, even though in bacteria, lateral gene transfer, which will result in organisms having very large different gene contents, you know, that organisms can have certain genes very different from others, you can still have phenotypic differences arising through the differential regulation of core set of genes that are conserved between bacterial species. So in that term, going back to bacteria, I'll quote, you know, some of you will be familiar with the quote from Jacques Monod, which is, what is true of E. coli is true for the elephant. But based on what I told you today, may not be true for Salmonella. So that's the story that I have to tell you. Okay. That's it. Jim?
How many million years ago, approximately, E. coli and Salmonella emerged?
100 to 120 million years ago, estimates from Howard Ochman and Alan Wilson. Jim?
This problem of what happens inside of macrophages, it's always been a problem to me, because I'm not sure what the environment really is. I think I asked you that about a year ago sometime.
Yeah.
Have you considered the possibility that Pro-Q could be both repressed by the magnesium under normal environment and actually be shown to some other vectors inside the
That possibility is always present. You know, you can, But I will tell you one experiment that I will interpret arguing against that possibility, and it's the following. So Sam Miller at the University of Washington will make that statement, will say that, yes, we have identified magnesium as the signal for FOQ in vitro, but the signal in vivo is something else. I always like things to be simple, so I think it's, if I identify the signal in vitro, it's the same signal in vivo. But the actual experiment is the following. If the signal in vivo was something that had nothing to do with magnesium, we should be able to manipulate perhaps the magnesium concentration in vivo, and then it shouldn't make a difference. So we did that experiment. So if you take, for example, the wild-type Salmonella strain that harbors a 4P activating gene fused to GFP, like MGTC fused to GFP, and you introduce it inside a macrophage, and at different times you go and throw some magnesium to the tissue culture media to let the eukaryotic cell take it up and hope that some of it will end up in the same compartment where Salmonella is. So many things should happen. And if magnesium didn't make a difference, if the signal was something unrelated, then the gene should still be turned on. If the signal, if magnesium is something that is affecting expression in that compartment, then it will turn it off. And it turns out that if you add magnesium, you turn off expression of MGTC inside a macrophage. Well, so the question is, so what experiment do you think will unequivocally rule out that there is no other signal inside a macrophage? So I will let you do it. I am convinced that this is the, I don't see, so the question is, why do you feel the need to invoke that there should be another signal? Why is it that you think that it cannot be magnesium inside the cell, that there must be something else?
I'm just trying to be paying.
Well, that's I wanted to clarify that for the audience. No, so that's the question. You know, there is also, there are other elements, for example, that I would argue, for example, this MGTC gene of Salmonella is in vitro. An MGTC minus mutant does not grow in a defined media of low magnesium. And that mutant does not grow inside a macrophage. I like to believe that it's because the compartment where Salmonella resides inside a macrophage is a low magnesium environment, and it's really the same phenotype. So I guess you can always argue that there is something else. But
perhaps direct magnesium. When you're able to measure the magnesium of the phagosomal compartment,
that will
find that it's very low directly.
Yes. So that has not been possible to do, to actually determine biochemically, although we have tried, it just hasn't worked. Yeah.
You had your sketch of what was going on in the low magnesium environment, and you, so the sensor was sitting on the inner membrane, and then you said, so it was sensing external magnesium, but then it was transporting outer membrane bound magnesium. How much is the concentration difference between
periplasm and... I don't know, but my idea is that essentially there will be pretty much the same between the periplasm and the outside world.
And the fact that there's a reservoir won't buffer the
thing. Well, there may be, I don't know, yeah. But I don't know of anybody who has actually measured that relative concentration, let's say, in the periplasmic space. Yes? Could you say that again? I didn't hear it.
I thought you said that PMRB repressed PMRB.
No, PMRA represses PMRB. Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Or is the expression of the protein? Is the possibility? I'm trying to say there are times making are off before the signal and inactivated? That would.
I believe so, and actually, expression of 4P activated genes inside a macrophage does not happen until, at least in vitro, you know, in the laboratory with a, you know, macrophage, either primary macrophages or a, you know, macrophage-like cell line, until 4 or 5 hours post salmonella internalization. So what I believe is that that phagosome that will contain salmonella is not the same immediately after salmonella has been internalized than as a function of time, that things are changing in that phagosome and the signal is not triggered to high enough levels until that time. And this is work, you know, the sort of this kinetics of expression is being done by a number of laboratories from Sam Miller, Brett Finley, our own. I mean, it's all, everybody coincides. I'm going to reply, Mike Mayhem might have done it as well. Yeah.
There's PMR, and there's one on the...
No, no, you mean that are connected, for example, by PMRD? Is that what you're saying? No.
That would be if you were going to look at the protein regulon, so whether it's directly activated or in the case of PMR-AB, I mean, that regulon is...
There's only, from what I know is this is one, mm-hmm. And then if you believe the results that were published by Mizuno and Warner in molecular microbiology about this DNA array data for all E. coli two component systems done on LB broth, then that would suggest that a 4P4Q controls transcription of another two component system known as RESD, I think, RESD, or yeah, there's another two-component system that is controlled at transcriptional level based on those results. But it hasn't been tested, as far as I know.
Is there one also on the SPY2 transcription
system? Well, the data in the literature is controversial, let's put it that way. There are people, I don't think they say that they control transcription of these... It may. I mean, I don't know. So some people say that the 4PQ system controls expression of genes in this particular locus in which there's another two-component system, and some people say that it doesn't. And I'm not taking sides yet there.
Well, I think it sort of suggests that there, so 4PQ system you're suggesting could be activated within macrophages. It may also be in its active state, potentially in soil somewhere. And then within each of those environments, there may be yet different microenvironments. Which
would absolutely.
Yet so I think, and I'm wondering whether that may be one way to get at that is to try to find out how many different regulatory systems are within the below.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
This magnesium reservoir hypothesis for LPS,
mm-hmm.
Is that used in other... Is there any evidence for that being a mechanism of as a reservoir for other ions? It's interesting. It's an interesting idea.
The idea is comes, you know, and actually with the help of Hiroshi Nikaido at Berkeley, we actually went and calculated what was the percentage of the total magnesium content of a bacterial cell that is actually present in the LPS. Before we did the experiments, I thought, well, maybe it would be, you know, 1%, you know, something like that. It's actually over 35%. You know, you have to make a lot of assumptions taking, you know, data from the late 50s, actually, when people were doing this type of measurements. And if you do, so sometimes this is the value that you come up with. I think it wouldn't, I mean, in experimentally, people have found that there are about 4 moles of magnesium per mole of LPS. There's about 1 mole of calcium per mole of LPS. In particular, media in which E. coli and salmonella have been grown to sort of derive these calculations. And then you can group all the other divalent cations that you want, you know, and you get essentially half a mole of those per mole of LPS. I think the reason that magnesium, in my opinion, would make sense is because you do use it as a cofactor for a number of reactions inside the cytosol, and you do not use these other divalent cations. So you would store it, if anything, something that you're going to use, not something that you never use. Because I thought if it's so great to be resistant to the antimicrobial peptides, why not just modify the thing to begin with? We don't have to worry about having magnesium there binding all the time. But the fact of the matter is that there is, you know. So, well, I don't know, this is just...
Because if you look at yeast versus E. coli, yeast have big storage for phosphate and E. coli doesn't. Would the LPS be a possible storage site for phosphate? It sounds like you're saying no.
No, I don't know. I haven't thought about that, to tell you. But
it's an order of magnitude difference between, or almost, I think, between E. coli and yeast in terms of phosphate storage.
Yeah, I don't know.
Hey, if you have a constitutive PMRA, does that affect the stability to actually affect mice? So, if, you know, if it made all those modifications before it gets into the status?
We have not tested such a mutant. When such a sort of similar situation in the 4PQ regulon is done, that is attenuated for virulence in Salmonella. Yeah. Positive feedback of their own thing. Well, I think in many cases there is. I mean, I think OnParMZ is a case in which it's not, so maybe the exception, but 4P4Q, it is positively autoregulated. PMRA, PMRB is also positively autoregulated. Most of them are. I don't know that that has. So usually the way the systems work is that there are two promoters. One promoter is constitutive, that in my opinion will provide a background level of expression, so when the organism experiences the signal, can all of a sudden trigger the thing, and then it will start amplifying the signal and commit to one state. And that seems to be more like a switch, you know, you just... So maybe that's the correlation, those systems that are more like a switch are positively autoregulated, and those that are more like a gradient are not, but that's...
I think in nitrogen systems, there's evidence that it's, there's a cascade of, that it also allows for ordering of the high affinity and low affinity.
Time for a break. Yeah? Thank you.